time now for the nationally syndicated radio show, The World of Lori Zook. And now, here she is, the smart, the sexy, the savvy, Divine Miss C.
And welcome to the show. I am Lori Zook, and today I have a Masters in Legends special for you. I've got musician, singer, and actor Steve Sterner joining me from New York today. Steve's specialty is scoring silent films and playing live with them, which is very unusual. He's a very rare breed of musician. Thanks for being my guest, Steve.
Well, thanks for having me.
Well, let's start way back at the beginning. Talk about your family. Did you come from a musical family?
Well, my family, they're all music lovers, my sister plays the guitar and piano. My parents both loved music and exposed me to music at a very, very young age. And my uncle Sam Sterner, was a very big choir leader, conducted his own Jewish choir for many decades, and was tops in the country for a while. He had his own radio show. He sang services up at Grossinger's and Kutcher's up in the Catskills, sang with all the great cantors, and that was some of the first music that I was exposed to when I was a little boy.
All right, so that's some of your earliest memories, but what about wanting to play the piano, sing, and act, all of which you do extremely well?
Well, I always enjoyed music, like I said. When I was a little boy, 3-4 years old, we had a grand piano, and my mother tried to give me lessons, and I was just too young. So she waited, sold the piano. We eventually moved to a different address, and my mother purchased another piano, an upright this time. And at that time, I was 10 years old, and that's when I started taking lessons, because I always loved the piano. Acting and singing, I loved it all. I really enjoyed it. I loved watching the variety shows on TV, and we would do... My sister and my cousin and I would do shows for the family and friends when they had them over for dinner. We'd set up a sheet in the hallway, and that would be the curtain, and we'd come out and we'd sing songs and do comedy and stuff, and I've always enjoyed it.
Now, was there any particular style of music when you studied, and was your mother your first teacher again when you were 10?
No, my mother was not my teacher. She paid for the piano.
Okay. It's hard to teach your own kids, I think, but...
Yeah, especially if she didn't play herself. Although she sang and she loved music, so did my father. They were both... had a huge album collection, and that's part of what I enjoyed, too. My favorite song when I was a little boy was Eartha Kitt singing a Turkish song called Ushkadara. I don't know why, I just love that song. The kind of music I studied when I took lessons was classical, which is the best kind of piano lessons to take if you want to be a piano player or a pianist, because that encompasses all, it's good for all styles. It will help you, you know, your scales and your theory and your chords, chord
right.
progressions and finger exercises to limber up your fingers. Classical is the best way to learn.
Now, what about as an adult? Did you have formal music training as an adult?
I became a music major at CCNY. I would have been a theater major, but their theater department wasn't that developed at the time. So I decided, well, I'll take the theater courses, but I'll learn more as a music major. And I became a music major, and that's when I started to appreciate Johann Sebastian Bach. I never really did appreciate him until I learned about theory, and then I listened to him with a whole different ear. It was an invaluable experience at CCNY, learning about music and exposing myself to it.
Right. Now, you know that I also play piano, so when you talk about Bach, the first thing I think about are the Bach inventions.
I love the Bach inventions. I never had to play them. As a piano student, my piano teachers gave me Clementi and Mozart and Chopin and Beethoven and...
Right.
But they didn't give me Bach. I never had to play a single Bach piece, and which is why my left hand is so weak. If I had played Bach, my left hand would have been built up, because those inventions are contrapuntal, and the left hand does a lot of work.
Right, very, very difficult pieces. Like you, though, I like the sonatinas for Clementi and Mozart
myself,
and Kulat. Yep, those are a lot more fun and musical. The Bach was lyrical, but again, you had to balance those hands, and you're right, the left hand ability has to be up to the right hand, which if you're right handed, it's usually not.
Correct. It's a lot of work.
Right.
And I've always been a lazy person. From the day I was born, I've been lazy. getting me to work my left hand as hard as my right hand would have been tough. But I probably would have done it if I had to.
Hey, it's never too late. You know, never too late.
That's true.
Now, who were your musical influences, in your childhood years? And then did it change throughout your life?
Like I said, my parents got me records, little golden records, and some of them were cute kiddie songs like I'm a Little Teapot Short and Stout.
That's my favorite, right.
Or Little Red Schoolhouse or Old MacDonald. But they also got me classical stuff. I had the Nutcracker Suite, excerpts from the Nutcracker Suite by Tchaikovsky, and Mozart's Rondo in A minor. And I loved those. I listened to those records, and that was my my influence was classical, basically. And also, you can't rule out television. I grew up in the 50s, and I loved watching Howdy Doody. That was my favorite show. And Pinky Lee. A lot of people won't know who Pinky Lee was, but people my age will know who he was. He was a fabulous entertainer, loved kids, had a very entertaining show, was a fabulous tap dancer, and he did a lot of songs, and so there were a lot of songs on Howdy Doody, too, and it exposed me to popular music of that time.
Now I'm just.
I was never into rock and roll for some reason. There are rock and roll songs that I enjoy, but I was, other kids would listen to the big hits on radio, and I just wasn't interested in that. I was more classical and theater and film and popular songs that of the day.
Right. Now, I'm a few years younger than you, but I'll tell you what I remember about classical are the old cartoons like Bugs Bunny. If you remember,
well, you're talking about Carl Stalling, who was a genius. Carl Stalling was the greatest orchestrator and musical director for cartoons that lived. The Warner Brothers cartoons are they great influence on me. Even before Carl Stalling, cartoons were always very musical. And yes, definitely, the Warner Brothers cartoons were works of genius.
Now, it's interesting because when you mention, putting the music to the cartoons, in a way, that's kind of what you do to silent films. There's sort of a parallel there, right?
Correct. In a way, you're right. I don't do it as well or as extensive. See, it's a little different. All that music is all written out. It's all written out to the cartoon. It's all timed perfectly to the split second. What I do is I improvise. So, yes, we're both scoring films, but with me it's an improvisation thing.
All original.
With Carl Stalling it was more exact. And, it was wonderful.
Now, how did you turn professional? How old were you, and what was the turning point for you? Did you become professional still in college?
I found a copy of a theater newspaper called Backstage, it was Show Business back then, when I was 16. And I looked into it, and it had all these notices of auditions. And I thought, audition? Wow, I could go to an audition and try out for a show, because at that time I had all done, all the shows I had done were in school or in camp. And so I started going to auditions, and I auditioned for a Broadway show. I got so excited. I auditioned for, it was my first audition, it was for a show called The Happy Time, a musical directed by Gower Champion. And I wasn't in the union or anything, so they were looking for boys, and I went down to the theater, and there was a whole line of boys anywhere from 4 years old to 30.
Well, that's a big age range, yeah.
Yeah, and the younger ones, the youngest ones had their stage mothers with them, and some had top hats and tails, you know, with a cane. They had a routine to do. This is back in the mid-60s.
Okay.
And I went on stage, and my audition song I chose to sing was an Alan Sherman parody. Alan Sherman was the song parodist who came up with the Hello Mudda, Hello Fada, which
right.
was a big hit in the 60s. Well, he did a parody of 5 Foot Two Eyes of Blue called My Martian Gal. It was 8 Foot Two, solid blue, 5 transistors in each shoe. Has anybody seen my gal? So I sang that song, and they stopped me after about 16 bars, and the director asked me to walk around the stage. And I walked around the stage, and I got very excited because he hadn't asked anybody else to walk around the stage. And then he said, okay, thank you. And I walked off, and I said, what do I do now? What do I do now?
Right.
And the stage manager said, nothing, you go home. And if they're interested, they'll call you. I said, do they know my phone number? I said, yes, you filled out a card. I said, oh, okay. Well, that summer I was a camper waiter in summer camp, and any time the phone rang, I said, wait a minute, don't answer it, it could be David Merrick. Of course, it never was David Merrick, and I auditioned for another 2 years until I got my first summer stock job when I was 18.
Wow, that's got to be tough going on, all those auditions, just throwing yourself out there, right?
You don't even know the half of it.
Oh my.
After I got my first job and I finally got into the union Actors Equity, I auditioned for another 10 years before I got another union job. And I was working at the time with the Theater for Young Audience, so I was making money and doing what I loved doing, but I didn't get another job outside of that children's theater company for another 10 years. But I was very persistent, and I believe that I didn't think I was God's gift to acting, but I believed I was good, and I believed I deserved to work, and because audiences liked me. So, and I, more important than that, I loved doing it, and that's why I persisted in doing it.
Yeah.
Now that I'm older, I'm tired already of all the auditioning for the 30, 40 years of pounding the pavement.
Wow.
But, you know, I'm getting ready to get my my pension. So
you can relax a little bit then?
Yeah, I'll relax a little bit, but I'm not going to stop working.
Well, that's right. Well, don't go anywhere. We're going to take a quick commercial break. When we come back, I'm going to have you play some of the things that you did for the silent films.
Okay.
All right. Stay with us.
Central Payment, your number one credit card merchant service provider in the industry. Providing e-commerce solutions, POS systems, standalone terminals, mobile apps, and much more, call Central Payments' James Carner at 813-777-4332. Looking for the lowest rates in the industry and number one customer service? Call Central Payments' James Carner at 813-777-4332. That's James Carner, 813-777-4332.
Do you suffer from back, neck, or body pain? Do you suffer from migraines or have jaw or face pain? Has conventional medicine failed you? Were you injured or in an accident? Call chiropractic physician Dr. Dan Maddock at 813-935-1664. Dr. Dan has helped thousands of patients gain relief for more than 30 years. Dr. Dan is caring, gentle, and takes his time with each patient. He's also a past president of the International Craniopathic Society, a special certification of only 300 chiropractors worldwide. Dr. Dan helps patients from the neck up and the neck down. Dr. Dan accepts most insurance plans. Don't continue to live in pain. Call 813-935-1664. Today. That's 813-935-1664, and get on track to better health.
And welcome back to my Masters and Legends special with Steve Sterner. Now, Steve, I'm going to ask you to give some examples. I know you're at your piano, and maybe you can give some examples of the different types of themes that you've played or that you've scored, you've written for some of these silent films.
Okay, sure. Let's see. There's the first silent film I ever saw in a theater, actually it was at the Museum of Modern Art with live piano, was a film called The General, starring Buster Keaton. I had never seen a Buster Keaton film, and I had never seen a silent film with live accompaniment. So when the lights went down and the piano started playing and the film started, I felt like I was transported back into time, into 1925. And it was a magical experience. And anyway, I eventually got to play the general. These are some of the themes I wrote for the film. It takes place during the Civil War. It's about a train engineer who has his train stolen by the Northern forces. And sort of Civil War sounding kind of music. Now, he had a girl he loved, and this is the theme for the love theme. Now, the theme of the enemy, the Northern forces, was written actually by a friend of mine. He wrote a musical. It was a play with music that opened on Broadway called Blood Red Roses, and there was part of the overture that I loved, and I asked his permission, and he said, of course, use it. And this was the Northern forces. It was... And that was that. And then there was a sub-theme that I played, which was... et cetera, and I would... I improvise around those themes. I just played a film recently called Limelight, a British silent film, a wonderful film. It took place during the 20s in the Limelight District, nightclub district, Chinatown in England, and this was my theme for Limelight. Here's another kind of a film called Grandma's Boy, starring Harold Lloyd. It's about a boy who loves his grandmother, and he's teased by everybody for being a sissy. He can't stand up for himself and be brave. And anyway, this was the theme for Grandma's Boy. Sorry. Thank you. And there was a wonderful film that I've only played once, a film starring Pola Negri called Hotel Imperial. And there was it was about a heroine during the war who helped helped Austria during wartime, but a very brave woman. And anyway, my love theme for that was a nice theme that I wish I could play again. I wish I could play that film again so I could play the theme again. But anyway, it goes...
That was absolutely beautiful, and I I can hear your classical training. And you know what I also like is I like your walking bass lines.
Yeah, sometimes they walk. Sometimes, unfortunately, I play a lot of wrong notes because my eyes are on the screen 95% of the time, and I'm not watching my fingers. So every once in a while, I have to stop watching the screen and reorient my fingers to the keyboard. But I wish I were less sloppy. But I'm a sloppy pianist. There's nothing I can do.
We're smiling here because we're going, wow, you sound great. I mean, first off, you have to have an amazing memory because you've scored over 300 films. I know that. But how do you remember all these themes, even though you're composing them? If I had written all these different themes, I don't know. I would just remember them by memory.
Well, I write them out. I write them down. I have a little folder for each film that I've played. I take a legal pad and I copy down all the action from the film, like a stenographer, and it's anywhere from 5 to 14 pages, depending on how long the film is. And then I write my themes, and I notate them on music paper. Then I fold the music paper over the legal pad paper, and there's my little folder for that film. So if I had to play The Lady in the Beard, a Yasujiro Ozu's Japanese silent film, I just open it up, and I'm looking at it right now, and I say, oh, Lady with the Beard, I see. The main theme is... I remember it anyway, but there are a lot of films that I played that I don't remember the themes I've written, and that's why I write them down. But a lot of films, I do remember the themes. My music is sort of memorable, I hope.
Very much so. I mean, do you have any plans to publish your music for other, you know, silent pianists? I mean, if I wanted to get your music, how would I want to be you, Steve, because I like what you just played.
I don't know. I have no plans to publish them, but I don't know. Maybe in my will, I'll just leave all my my stacks of notes and music to Lincoln Center and say, look, if anybody's interested, these are themes for silent films that I've written. And I know every once in a while, someone will come up to me after a film and say, can I buy a CD anywhere, or is it published?
Right.
And I have to say, no, it's not. I'm sorry.
I think it would be fascinating because, I mean, in the old days, you and I discussed this a long time ago, but a long, long time ago when I was a kid, I told you a story how I went to the library and I loaned out a book for silent films where it had different themes. And I know you mentioned you had that book.
I have that book, yes.
Right. So what happens all over, you know, the world when they play silent films? There can't be that many Steve Sterners that score original music, and so what happens at other film forums?
Well, hopefully there'll be other people that are composers that would like to continue playing for silent films and who can write good melodies. And you know, there are tricks and there are techniques that I could probably impart to someone who's aspiring. But hey, listen, when I started, I didn't have anybody to tell me what to do, you know, and I'm sure there are other people who could do it too. You know, if If you've ever seen a musical comedy or an opera, you know, you get your idea of how to work the music and just be true to the film.
Now, how did you get your first silent film gig? How did that come about?
It came about, I had a friend in New York by the name of Wayne DeGrippant, who worked at the Thalia Theater on 95th Street. That was an art house that's been around. My mother used to go there when she was young. It's still there. It's not an art house anymore. It's not a revival house. But anyway, he worked there, and he also threw parties, and he was an avid cartoon collector. He collected all kinds of cartoons, Max Fleischer cartoons and Warner Brothers cartoons and Disney cartoons. And anyway, one cartoon that he showed was a silent Coco the Clown cartoon, and he asked if I could play piano for it. I said, gee, I don't know. I'll try. And I did, and he said, wow, that was great. Everybody enjoyed it. And he said, we're showing Flesh and the Devil with Greta Garbo in a few weeks, so could you play for it? I said, no. I said, no. That's like a full length. That's a 90-minute film. You know, I'm not an improviser. What am I going to play? He said, oh, you could do it. I said, no, I can't. You don't understand. I don't improvise. And he couldn't find anybody to do it. And I finally, rather than run it silent, I said, okay, I'll try. And I did, and I evidently wasn't that bad because they asked me back to do more. And that's how I started playing silent films.
Pretty interesting. So you're putting all these themes together. So bring me to the theater now. You sit down at the piano because you've already kind of put together these different themes that you have. You had to make notes, right, so that you know the timing.
Yes. And while I'm taking notes for the film, if the action that happens in the film, if I notice there's a recurring character that warrants a theme, I'll make a little note in the margin, say theme for this person or theme for that person or a theme for this emotion or this thing. For instance, in the film Greed, itself has a theme, the theme of greed.
Okay.
Then I sit at the piano, and sometimes it comes easy and sometimes it comes very hard. It comes very hard when I'm not inspired. When I am inspired, it comes easy.
Okay.
That's why Buster Keaton and Harold Lloyd, very easy to score, because I'm nuts about them both. They're both brilliant, brilliant actors, brilliant comedians, brilliant comedies, and it's very easy for me to come up with themes for them. But there are other films where it's a lot harder.
All right, now let's talk about that. What were the easiest were probably the Buster Keaton. What were the hardest?
Well, those are to score. The hard films to score are films that are, they're not emphatic in any way. They're just films of everyday life. You know, I want to come up with an interesting piece of music, and sometimes it's hard to find one. By the way, being that Keaton and Lloyd are very easy to score, they're also the hardest to play. And the reason they're hard to play is because there's so much action and fast action and visual sight cues. Sometimes I feel like my hands are going to fall off. There's a film that Harold Lloyd did called Girl Shy, where the last half hour of the film is a chase. It's the chase never stops. And or in Ben-Hur, actually, where there's the chariot race.
Right.
I feel like my hands are going to fall off because I'm trying to keep up with the pace of the film. So those are the real hard ones. The love stories are the easy ones to play.
Probably more relaxed. Yeah, more relaxed. But I'm sitting here trying to picture myself. Okay, so I'm sitting at a piano in a theater, and I have to watch everything. Not only have I composed all the music to it, I have to string it together with the correct timing. So, and I'm looking at the screen, and I'm not really looking at my hands because I'm following.
Right.
Do I have that right?
Yeah, that's right. Also, my themes I have to practice in a whole bunch of different keys. You can't play everything in one key because people start yawning, get bored. You have to learn how to play it in like 5, 6, 7 different keys.
Interesting. I was going to ask you if everything was all in the same key for a song.
No.
Or if you're it's all changing to break it up, right?
It's all constantly changing because different keys evoke different moods. And also, it gives a change. It gives you change. If it's all in the same key, you just get tired and bored after a while.
Gotcha. Now, Lee Clark here has a question for you.
Hey, Steve. You're talking about different artists and, if they're easy to score for or not. What about Chaplin?
Chaplin is tough. First of all, I'm not allowed to play any of his feature films. because it's the Chaplin estate will only use Charlie Chaplin's music for that, the music that he himself wrote for the films.
Okay.
I did, however, years ago play for the Gold Rush. But his shorts I'm allowed to play for, and I've played about 8 or 10 of his shorts. And they're very difficult. They're very difficult to play because there's something happening every 5 seconds. There's another thing happening, and I like to catch as many as I can. And it's also a lot of fast-moving stuff, a lot of chase stuff. So, yeah, Chaplin is tough to play for, definitely.
And so you said he scored... He wrote the score for some of his other films.
Oh, yeah, for his feature films.
Uh-huh.
All of his feature films he scored. The Kid, City Lights, Modern Times, they were all with music written, and The Gold Rush, all with music written by Charlie Chaplin.
So the piano player would be furnished the music to...
No, the music is right there on the film. He scored the film, and that's the way the film is shown, with the music on the film, with the soundtrack. Of his music.
Interesting. I didn't know that myself.
Yeah.
Now, how many people do what you do? Because it's such a specialized skill. Is there an association for people that do what you do, or do you know each other?
Back in 1925, there were hundreds and hundreds of them all over the country. And everybody had a relative that did it. But today, no, because there are hardly any places that still show them with live accompaniment. So I can count the silent film accompanists in New York on one hand. There may be between five and ten of us. But I would imagine any big city that if they're going to show a silent film with live accompaniment would have somebody who can do it. I know there's a few people upstate. There's a number of people in Los Angeles. But they're few and far between. Even when I started, there were a lot more theaters in New York showing silent films. We've lost a bunch. We've lost the Regency. We've lost the Elgin Theater. We've lost the Donnell Library that used to show them, and the Thalia. So there's even less demand today than there was 30 years ago. So there's not too many of us.
All right, now, what about kids learning to do? Is there any interest in kids or young adults to learn this art before it disappears?
I don't think so, but I might be wrong. But a wonderful program over at the theater that I play most of my films at, which is Film Forum in Manhattan on Houston Street, every Sunday at 11 a.m., they have a Film Forum Junior film. And these are films that for the entire family, especially for kids. And these New York kids are sort of sophisticated, you know. There's some wonderful, you know, they'll show Mary Poppins one week, and next week they'll show A Tree Grows in Brooklyn, which is not the right. You know, it's a very sophisticated film for a child to see. They showed Frankenstein, which is another, you know, it's a scary film for a kid.
Right.
But sometimes they'll show a silent film with live, and I'll come in and I'll play for it, a Harold Lloyd film or a Buster Keaton film or some Laurel and Hardy shorts, and which is a wonderful thing because it's exposing kids to great artists. Buster Keaton is in 300 years, he'll still be a great genius that people see his films and they'll laugh, just like people do Shakespeare today, hundreds of years later, because his plays will always be great. And Harold Lloyd's films and Buster Keaton's films and Laurel and Hardy will always be great, too. But the problem is they're not being, there's not that much of a ready access to them.
Right.
So it's wonderful that Film Forum is doing that. Also, exposing kids to live piano accompaniment for silent films, which is, I think, the best way to see a silent film, unless the pianist is really rotten. A bad pianist can almost ruin a film. I've seen that, too. But it's a wonderful experience to be in a theater with other people with live music happening as the film is playing. Wonderful.
Well, when I get back to New York City to visit, I'm going to come see you at the Film Forum.
Definitely.
I'd like to do that. Now, talk about...
Well, let me know, and I'll arrange for a pass.
Oh, that would be great. Thank you. Talk a little bit about the music you wrote for something called The Donovan Affair.
The The Donovan Affair is a film that it was Frank Capra's first all-talking film, made in 1929. And the film exists in very good condition, the entire film. The only problem is that the sound discs have been missing for forever, for 60 or 70 years, the Vitaphone sound discs. So the film exists, this all-talking film with no talking, with no sound, no sound at all. It's totally silent. So Bruce Goldstein, who is the repertory programmer at Film Forum, came up with an idea to hire a group of actors and a sound effects man and have me at the piano, in addition to playing a few of the roles, also to provide the music, and recreate the lost sound. Now, he did this, it's a very long, drawn-out story. I'll make it short. He couldn't find a script anywhere. It didn't exist. He finally found about 50% of the script at the Board of Censors, and the rest had to be lip-read. We had to lip-read, and we did it at Film Forum, a live performance with a sound effects man, with a wind machine and lightning, and I was at the piano. I also played a stuttering doctor. It was very successful, and Turner Classic Movies was interested, and they had us come out to Hollywood and do it at the Egyptian Theater. So that was very thrilling, and it was a huge, huge success. It was a huge hit. People enjoyed it. We had a very talented group of actors, and the music for that was very different than music for a silent film because it was a talkie.
Right.
So my music had to be to start the film, to end the film, and there were wherever there were long, drawn out passages with no dialogue, with just action, I provided music.
Yeah, sounds like a lot of fun. Well, don't go anywhere, Steve. We're going to take a quick commercial break, and we'll be back in just a moment.
Okay.
Do you miss that old school sound that made radio great? Let me invite you to preview Philharmonic's Jack of All Trades at philharmonicblues.com, a collection of Americana blues available as a download for $7.99. You can sample each track on the album page and try before you buy. Philharmonic, Jack of All Trades at philharmonicblues.com. That's philharmonicblues.com.
Early in the evening, right on through the morning dew.
Are you looking for an affordable way to advertise to thousands of consumers nationally? If you own a business and didn't think you could afford radio advertising, you need to call me, Lori Zook, host of the nationally syndicated radio show, The World of Lori Zook. My show reaches thousands of people on 29 AM and FM stations nationwide, as well as through the internet. Additionally, your commercials will also be heard on all of my podcasts and throughout social media sites. Don't wait another minute. Call me at 813-777-4908, 813-777-4908, and let me bring your message to the nation and to help you gain more exposure. And we're back on The World of Lori Zook, Masters and Legends special today with Steve Sterner. Now, Steve, we've been talking about everything that you've done. I want to talk about you, but tell me a little bit about that bumper music and where it's from.
The bumper music.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, the bumper music that you've been playing.
Yes.
It's from a film called The Grim Game. This was a film starring Harry Houdini that was just unearthed recently, and Turner Classic Movies showed it. And they called me and asked if I would want to score the film. And I said, I'd love to. And so I recorded a piano score for them, and they showed it. I'll tell you, it was a huge thrill to hear Robert Osborne say, and now with a score by Steve Sterner. I was really tickled. I was very excited about that.
That's great. Now, I want to talk. Let's talk about you, because you've performed on Broadway, correct? You sing, you act, you play the piano.
Yes, all of the above, and I'm a musical director and a composer. I've been on Broadway in a musical called Oh Brother, a musical that was such an audience pleaser, but such a show that critics hated and didn't run too long. But it was a musical takeoff on a comedy of errors, that was a thrill, my voice was in a Tennessee Williams play called Clothes for a Summer Hotel. My friend Michael Valenti, the composer, wrote music for that, and he had a number of voices singing, and I was one of the voices. That's my Broadway experience, but I've also been off-Broadway in regional theaters and Atlantic City. I did a show. I was Julius LaRose's standby. And I ended up going on for 3 weeks. That was a thrill. That was a huge thrill.
So what kind of a schedule do you have? Because it sounds like you do so many things. Are you able, I guess, to coordinate everything? Is that difficult?
When I was younger, it was. When I was younger, I'd have 4 or 5 jobs at the same time. And I look back at some of my date books and think, that's impossible. It's impossible. I could not. How did I help? I'm getting a nervous breakdown just thinking about it. I can't do it anymore. I'm too old.
Yeah. I mean, it sounds like you do one gig and then you jump in the car or in a cab and then you go to the next one.
And then, I did theater for young audience for 33 years, and that was shows during the morning. And there were weekends where I'd have two shifts, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday, 2, 4, 8, 9 shows in a 3-day week, weekend, Friday, Saturday, and Sunday.
This is primarily in Manhattan, correct? In New York City?
In Manhattan, the Paper Mill Playhouse in New Jersey, in and around New York, yeah.
All I can think of is traffic and gridlock running from one gig to another going, am I going to make it in time?
Well, that's happened. That happened once where I was late for a silent film. They had to start the film without me, and I eventually got there about 10 minutes after the film started and started playing immediately.
Gotcha. Yeah, I've got to be rough. Now, you've also performed in Yiddish theater.
Yes, I've worked for the Joe Papp Yiddish Theater, the National Yiddish Theater Volksbühne, and the New Yiddish Rep. I've done shows for all three companies, and some good, some eh.
Yeah.
Some wonderful. Some of them were the best shows that I've done.
Yeah.
Again, going back to my roots, a lot of the music in the musical, the Yiddish musicals, are very close to me. It's in my blood, actually. So it was a joy to do those.
You know, it's interesting. I've interviewed a lot of musicians on this show, and the one tie-in is that none of them really did it for the money. Not that you don't need money to live, but they did it because they love the music. And when I speak with you, I could hear that come through your voice, is that you absolutely love what you do. You are living music is what you are.
Yeah, I didn't go into the business to make money, because if I did, I would have gone into another business. And I could have gone into another business because I was a grade A student. I went to Bronx Science. I was an engineering major at CCNY for a while. I could have gone into a lucrative business, but what's more important to me is doing what I love doing. And I think I'll live longer that way.
Yeah.
As long as I make enough money to get by, I'm very happy. I don't have any aspirations to be rich. I just want to be able to get by and live comfortably.
Right. Now, I got to ask you, on your site, I read that you've sung the part of a singing fire hydrant. So what was that all about?
That was years ago. That was, I don't know how many years ago, about 25 years ago. ABC, every Saturday morning, would have a lineup of shows for children, cartoons. And every once in a while, they would cut to a commercial, and there was a claymation of a fire hydrant. And let's see if I could do this for you.
Okay.
it was my voice singing, "After these messages, we'll be right back." And that was it.
I love that.
Three of them. Yeah, I did one where there was a dog sniffing around, and I squirted dog. Another one where I growled at the dog, and another one... I forgot what the third one was, but it had something to do with the dog. But they ran that for years. And,
did all your family
all the theater
and friends?
That I've done, I had a job playing in Cincinnati, and A little boy came up to me and said, are you an actor? I said, yes. He said, what did I see you in? I said, no, I don't do films. I do basically theater. I said, but you might have heard my voice. I'm the fire hydrant who sings after these messages. And the kid went nuts. He went ballistic. He said, that's you. That's the job that most people get excited about. And it was the stupidest little job that I did.
I was going to say, your family and friends obviously must have known that was you. And I could just imagine every time it came on, they went, that's Steve.
Well, no, my family and friends didn't watch Saturday morning cartoons. it was the kids who did.
Yeah, that's funny. Now, what's coming up for you as far as performances, acting, singing, playing?
Well, right now I've got I'm doing a reading of a Yiddish play at the end of June for the National Yiddish Theater Volksbühne. And tomorrow I'm playing two films at the Brooklyn Academy of Music, BAM Cinematheque. A new film that I haven't played yet called Shoes, made in 1916, and another film called People on Sunday that Billy Wilder was one of the screen writers on, that I played about 30 years ago, only once, and I've never played it since then. So it'll be nice to resurrect a few old themes. And then in a few weeks I'll be playing Easy Virtue at Film Forum, which is an Alfred Hitchcock silent movie based on a Noel Coward play.
Okay,
now, how many people would know that Alfred Hitchcock directed a film based on a Noel Coward play?
Most people
would
not.
Many.
Right.
But it's a wonderful film. I really enjoy it. It's called Easy Virtue, and it's about the scandal of divorce.
Now, I got to ask you another question, because I thought this was kind of cool. You write puzzles. You do crossword puzzles.
I've always been a puzzle fanatic. I've always loved word puzzles and crosswords and acrostics and number puzzles since I'm a little boy. And I had a neighbor years ago, and he's still a very good friend of mine, Dale Copps, who taught me how to construct a crossword and a acrostic puzzle. And we would make puzzles to stump each other and get together at night, and he'd give me his puzzle, and I'd give him my puzzle, and we would solve our puzzles together. He lives in Vermont, and he's a wonderful author, too. He's an expert on Sherlock Holmes.
Another good
he started
topic.
Me. And I made puzzles, this was about 30, 35 years ago. And I submitted a few to the Times, and they rejected a few, and then they accepted a few. So I had a few of my crossword puzzles appear in the New York Times, which was a big thrill, too.
Yeah, it's interesting. I mention it because I myself love puzzles, and I don't know if that's related to the music math, but the way your brain thinks, you know, you're reading dots basically on a page for music and condensing that into what you're performing. But doing the actual puzzles, I'm fascinated by puzzles also, and I think somehow that's related.
Yeah, well, definitely math and music. Most musicians were very good in math. Mathematics, because there is math in music, you know, counting the measure and, you know, things like that. And intervals on the piano, a major third, a minor third, an octave.
Right.
It's all involved in numbers. So most musicians were good in math. There are those musicians that are fabulous musicians that were terrible in math. It happens.
Right. Depends on how your brain thinks. Now, I want to ask you something for our listeners, because we always like to give out maybe a little bit of advice or have you give out advice for aspiring musicians, you know, especially high school or college students looking to pursue a career in music. What advice would you give?
I'd say do it because you love it. Don't do it because you so much because you want a career. Do it because you have a need to do it. Before I realized I was going to go into a musical career, I would take two scores out of the public library every week, either an opera or a musical that played on Broadway, and I would sight read through the scores because I loved discovering new music and I loved to practice my sight reading. This was something I didn't do for money. I didn't think I was going to be doing it professionally. I just did it because I loved to do it. And that's the best advice I can do is do it because you have a need and a love for it. My friend Michael, the composer, is very often commissioned to write, and he's written some wonderful things. He wrote the processional for the Pope when Pope Francis came to town. And he's written umpteen Broadway shows and music for television series. When he's not commissioned to do anything, he sits at the piano and he writes music. He's not getting paid to do it. He does it because it's his soul. It's his heart and soul. And he has this drive to do it. And that's the best reason you know, if you want a career in music, do it to do it. And
right.
if you can end up making, and if you, it ends up, you're not making a career out of it, who cares? You're still doing it and still loving it.
Yeah.
You know, you're still doing it for yourself, for your soul.
I think a lot of musicians, you know, they dig maybe to get a degree in something different than music, maybe sometimes in music. But a lot of them, I think it starts out as a part-time thing. And then if it really develops where they can support themselves, then that's what they do. But for a lot of people, it's hard because I think a lot of it's connections. And so how important were connections for you in getting networked?
Always. Okay. In any business, connections are important. Yeah, I've gotten some of my best connections in some of my worst jobs. I've gotten terrible jobs where I thought, oh, God, should I leave now or should I stick it out? Let me stick it out. You don't know who's going to be there working with you, who's going to think, you know, that you might be right for something else. And some of my best work I got because I had a connection that knew my work. So, yeah, connections are always good. And that's why it's always good to work in as many places as you possibly can, meet as many people as you can, and connections will help, unless you're terrible. If you're terrible,
it's not going to work,
can't do
right?
anything for you. I mean, you've got to have the talent to back it up. But, you know, there's the old saying, being at the right place at the right time, and there's a lot of truth in that. You know, it's a lot of it is the toss of the dice. There are a lot of great, talented people that never get known and never work, you know, because just for any number of reasons. It could be the toss of the dice, or it could be they're not motivated enough, or they're not interested enough, but they have the talent. And there are a lot of people that do get to work that really shouldn't be working.
Yeah.
Not a lot. There are not a lot of them, but there are some. And they get their work through other means.
Sometimes it's the connections and not the talent, but it really should be the talent first.
Exactly. It should be, you know, you have connection and they think you're right because of what you can do, not who you are.
Right. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining me today. It's been so much fun. I've actually learned a lot. If people want to contact you, what's the best way for them to get a hold of you?
Well, they can get a hold of me. I have a website. It's not anything great, but it's a website about my silent film playing, and it has a list of all the films that I've played. You could always go there, and that'll give you my phone number and my email address, and you could always contact me through my email address is Steve Sterner, stevesterner@ymail.com. And that's that.
Great. Well, thanks again for joining me. And join us next week again on The World of Lori Zook.